Welcome to the Boost VC podcast, where we talk to incredible guests building our sci-fi future. We're going to dig into the latest topics around venture capital, startups, and sci-fi technologies. I'm your host, Adam Draper, founder and managing director of Boost VC, and I'm a fourth generation venture capitalist. Are you ready to rock? On today's episode of the Boost VC podcast, I get a chance to interview Michael Sidgemore, who is an investor with Broadhaven. But more than that, I have to say that Michael Sidgemore writes the best email introductions of all time. Everyone can take a hand out of his book, because in a world that is exceedingly more transactional and more efficient, he takes the time in order to explain exactly why each person should get to know the other person. And it is sort of his thing now. I love it. Today's episode, we talk about a lot: beginning of his career, what drove him to venture capital, how his life changed when he joined Room to Read, and an incredible number of topics that focus really hard on fintech investments. I think you will get to know Michael Sidgemore very well, and I think you should. Please enjoy. All right. And we're here on the Boost VC podcast with my friend and investor and confidant, Michael Sidgemore, who's a partner at Broadhaven Ventures, which is an early stage venture capital fund. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
To the Boost VC podcast. Okay. So who are you?
Who am I? That's a great question. Where do you want to start with that?
I feel like most people get stumped on the who are you question when I ask them on the podcast. So who are you? I'm stumping you.
You are stumping me. I am Michael Sidgemore. As Adam said, I am an early stage fintech VC at Broadhaven Ventures, where we invest in early stage fintech companies. I've also had quite an eclectic career that started kind of my journey to finance, started actually trying to play soccer in the UK.
And where were you before that?
Where was I before that? So I grew up outside of DC, went to high school in the city in DC, was a soccer player, and then tried to go play in the UK, actually. My club team went and played in the UK. We played against some Premiership youth clubs when I was a kid, and I just always had this dream of trying to play soccer in the UK. To totally qualify this, I was just okay. My friends and teammates would probably laugh at me if you say I'm an incredible soccer player, like you've told me before, but I was nicknamed One Speed Sidgemore for a reason.
Was it zero or one?
I had one speed. I was a defender. I was an outside defender, left back. And forwards were much faster than me, but I had incredible endurance. So my speed at the first minute of the game was the same speed as the 90th minute. So all those forwards who were super fast.
So you were really good at the end.
I was really good at the end. Yes.
But that's when
I try to finish strong.
I mean, in soccer, you have to finish strong. That's the goal, is finishing strong. And so we've bonded over this because I played tennis and I feel the same way about my tennis game.
Yep.
Most people would say the exact same thing. My thing was just I had a huge serve. So that was my whole...
That's really important. If you can beat people on the serve, then you don't even need a volley.
That was the hope. that was the entire game plan while I was playing. So then you went from soccer. Then what did you move towards?
Yeah. So I had what ended up being an accidental gap year before going to Middlebury College in Vermont. I had a year to go and try to play soccer in the UK, ended up getting injured, needing hip surgery, actually. I was quite young for that. I was 18, but found out I needed hip surgery on both hips over the course of a year. So ended up having this accidental gap year between high school and Middlebury, where while I was recovering from my hip surgery, I actually ended up reading a book called Leaving Microsoft to Change the World by a Microsoft executive in Asia in 1999 named John Wood, who was burnt out and took a trek to Nepal. And in doing this trek kind of through the mountains in Nepal, wandered into this library the school that had no books in its library. And he ended up saying, I grew up on public libraries in the US. Andrew Carnegie is my hero. I need to come back to the US and start collecting books and then bring these books back to kids in Nepal, because everybody should have access to education. So long story short, he wrote this book about how he went from collecting books, bringing them back on the back of a yak to Nepal, and then launched this multinational nonprofit organization called Room to Read that 10 years later, by 2007, when he wrote his book, was across 10 countries.
I knew this.
DRK.
The DRK Foundation. Yes. This is one of their like major successes.
Yes. So John's book actually changed my life. I read his book. He's an incredible entrepreneur.
Well, now I have to read that book. What's it called again?
It's called Leaving Microsoft to Change the World.
Okay, great.
But yeah, so John's book changed my life. I read the book while I was on this gap year. I saw his email in the back of the book and just literally cold emailed him and said, "Hey, John, you know, I'm on this accidental gap year. Read your book. Was incredibly inspired. What can I do to help?" And he said, "You know, we actually are opening up our office in London. We'd love to have an intern in the office in London." So ended up working for Room to Read for 7 months on my gap year. And it really blew my mind about what nonprofits meant. It was Room to Read was run like any great organization. They had a ton of people from the for-profit sector. They had ex-Goldman employees, ex-Microsoft employees. My boss in London worked till midnight every night, and they monitored and evaluated everything, just like any, you know, for-profit business would. Their just output was impact instead of profit. So that really changed my mind on how people could think about investing their capital, whether it was for-profit or nonprofit. And what happened after that was it made me think, okay, how do I learn how to create a business, whether it's for-profit or nonprofit, and also learn finance, which Middlebury as a liberal arts college didn't have kind of a specific finance track. So went to Middlebury after my year in London, and I actually had another freak accident, ended up needing a third hip surgery. I would not recommend going cliff jumping after you've had two hip surgeries. The soccer team took the entire team cliff jumping, and I probably shouldn't have done it, but injured my hip third time, and that was...
Just to get more detailed on that specific event, mm-hmm. I am picturing you falling and hitting like a rock, but
no,
it wasn't that.
It was jumping 45 feet from a cliff into a river, and I landed a little bit on my right hip, which I was a swimmer. I was a competitive swimmer growing up. I've done high dive all the time. I don't know what happened. I just landed a little funny and re-injured my hip, re-tore the cartilage. So needed surgery.
When you're jumping from that high up, it hurts.
Yeah, it was, again, probably not the smartest thing to do.
I hurt my tailbone when I jumped out of a helicopter or something at like 30, 35 feet. And like, so 45 is an extra 10 feet above that.
Yeah.
And that's...
It was pretty high. I vividly remember.
Were you able to swim to shore? Rivers are dangerous also.
Was able to swim to shore.
Okay.
The next few days started bugging me. And then that was honestly when I really started thinking about like life after soccer. I was like, because I ended up playing on a semi-pro team in the UK when I was there during my gap year. I recovered from my hip surgeries, played on a semi-pro team. They offered me enough money to like eat beans and toast for a few days, like 50 pounds a game. Not enough to really live off of. So that third hip surgery though really started to make me think about what did I want to do with my life. And credit to one of my professors at Middlebury, who was my political science professor, told him that, you know, about my experience at Room to Read, that I was passionate about international development, social policy, and also wanted to learn finance, to learn how to build a business. And he said, you should absolutely look at London School of Economics. So after a year at Middlebury, I transferred to London School of Economics, where I studied social policy and international relations. And then honestly, just kind of by luck, fell into learning about finance because my next door neighbor ran the world's largest student conference on hedge funds and private equity. So he encouraged me to come to the
learn through osmosis of friends.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. So I ended up going to the info session on that and ended up actually getting on the team. And then I got the most sponsors and speakers. So they said, you're president. So I ran the conference for the next 2 years. And I had to learn about hedge funds and private equity.
What's the key with the conferences? What do you think the key is?
With conferences in general?
Yeah, putting on a successful conference, what's the key?
Making content really interesting and changing it up every year. It's really hard to differentiate yourself as a conference, I think. So at LSE Alternative Investments Conference, to give you an example, we were able to, because we were a student organization, we were able to attract people like David Rubenstein or from Carlyle or Glenn Hutchins from Silver Lake, Lord Stanley Fink from Man Group, some of the biggest names in the hedge fund private equity industry. And we could get these speakers to come and give keynotes, but you want to find ways to make things really engaging for the audience. So what we did the 2 years I was there was 1 year we actually did kind of like the equivalent of a Shark Tank, but for best trade ideas on the hedge fund day. So we had a panel of four hedge fund managers come and actually rip apart, you know, trade ideas. So three students, we had anybody who wanted from the conference. We had 5,000 applicants for 300 seats. And then of those 300 seats, those 300 kids could apply to submit their trade idea. And the top three were selected to present in front of this panel of trade
ideas. How is a trade idea pitched? Is it like,
oh, it's like
sell Apple?
Yeah. So, you know, sell Apple, buy another stock. What it could have been any sort of trade idea, whether it was across, it was a, you know, commodities trade or a equities trade, whatever it may be. So it was just really a chance for these students to get exposed to
how
people in the industry. But that's the type of thing where I think if you can do fun stuff like that,
so
that makes conferences really
interesting. So good people and sort of newer formats would be a good way of doing it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who wants to throw a conference at some point that has people show up.
What kind of conference do you want to throw?
We've talked about doing sort of a sci-fi conference-ish.
You have a lot of toys to play with.
Yes.
So
toys. Basically, show off the toys, but also having, not curriculum, what do you call it when people are there? Content, I guess, around starting hard tech startups,
mm-hmm.
because I feel it's different than normal startups.
Yep.
But good question. I want to touch briefly on the mm-hmm. Measuring, because you said, you know, Room to Read
mm-hmm.
was really the change in your life that led you to, like, it sounds like that was a really important arc. How do you measure, like, the impact, like, as a nonprofit? Is that a...
Yeah, so I think depending on what your
books shared, books read.
Number of, you know, students who are now able to access libraries, and they have a track for girls scholarships. They provide girls scholarships in Room to Read's case. It could be how many books in local language titles are published. So they do a whole number of things. And for every nonprofit, they have their own KPIs. But I think just as a thinking about how investors would think about it. And I think of even nonprofit donors as investors, right?
Yeah.
They're investing their capital, but they're just getting a social return just like DRK did instead of a financial return like Boost VC would. But as long as you're sticking to a set of measurements and measuring those outcomes, then you
and
can
it's growing
measure that
over
impact.
Time, hopefully.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And what is your personal definition of success?
Personal definition of success. So I kind of split that into work life and personal life. So from a work life perspective, I think work life, if you can find something that you love doing to the point where it doesn't feel like work and it just feels like fun every day, then I think that's success. And working with people who are trying to follow their dreams, I feel like I get to do that every day. I've been on the operating side. I was first sales hire at Mosaic, a solar finance business. I helped build the sales team at a company called iCapital Network, which democratized access to alternative investments. And now I'm on the venture capital side, investing in early stage fintech entrepreneurs. And I feel like what I do now, it doesn't feel like work. It's just fun every day, working with entrepreneurs, helping them realize their dreams and impact people's lives. So that to me is work success. Yes, there will obviously be kind of ways to get measured, and you know, we can talk about kind of how do you measure success and the way different people think about that. But I think that when you start to think about specific numbers, or you know, I have to make X amount of money, I think you start to get on a hamster wheel that gets pretty tough to deal with.
Where do you have the most fun with what you're doing now?
Honestly, working with entrepreneurs who are just starting their businesses out. I was very early at iCapital, pre-product. I've been around kind of the entrepreneurial world for a while, and I just love helping people put their businesses together. I think that's the most fun stage of a business. Every stage of a business is really interesting and different, and companies that grow to scale have to go through different evolutions, and those different stages can be fun for different reasons. But for me, the kind of zero to one phase of how do you get from an idea, a team that's trying to figure it out, is the most fun, because everything that you do, every introduction you make to a possible customer, every introduction you make to a possible investor, every hire you make, every idea you come up with could have an impact on the business, and you can actually see that every day.
Okay, since LSE, basically, you've been on the trajectory where you ran the conference, and then everything's sort of been fintech for you.
Yeah.
So you're.
So I ended up at Goldman.
You're like DNA is running.
My DNA is
for profit, just greedy, horrible finance money.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think fintech has the ability to create massive impact.
Completely.
No,
actually, I mean, you know, I'm obsessed with the ocean. My biggest issue with the ocean is no one is greedy. So my biggest issue is that everyone's trying to like save the planet, and no one's just trying to like build businesses that will make money. And so now I'm just saying I'm the greediest person ever. When people ask me why I'm interested in the ocean, I'm just saying like, I want to make more money than I've ever made.
And look, there's nothing wrong with that. I think as long as you're cognizant of what impact you're making. And I think of impact as a sliding scale of negative impact to positive impact. There are companies that make tons of profit, but can have completely negative impact. There are companies that make very little money or make a lot of money that have totally positive impact.
Yeah, it's like the company soul of the company and value system.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And how kind of the company wants to measure what they're doing. There are plenty of companies that don't necessarily measure the impacts of what they're doing on the social impact side per se, but they are creating access to credit. I mean, there are lending businesses, whether it's here or abroad. We have a Mexican small business lender called Credit Justo. They're providing access to credit for small business owners in Mexico who are completely unbanked. And, you know, they're a for-profit business. They're doing extremely well. They raised a $10 million Series A from Kazakh Ventures in Latin America and QED, which is the founder of Capital One, Nigel Morris, his venture fund, one of the best fintech investors out there. And they're purely a for-profit business, but they're creating massive impact by giving small business owners access to credit, and they're helping grow a middle class there that is 50%+ underbanked, 50% cash economy. So you can imagine as time goes on, they're going to be able to make a big impact.
How has fintech sort of evolved since you've been a part of it? Mm-hmm. You've been involved in different pieces of it too. I mean, you're sort of the middle piece in the iCapital where you were sort of a connector between two different alternative investments and investors. How have you seen the evolution change?
Yeah, so I first started in fintech at the end of 2012 when I joined Goldman Sachs. I was on the principal strategic investments team at Goldman, which was making strategic investments into fintech companies on behalf of the firm's capital and their strategic initiatives. So end of 2012, 2013, there was about $3 billion of venture capital invested into fintech companies, which at the time felt very large, but still a long ways to go. By the end of 2016, I think you had north of like $16 billion a year invested into fintech companies, from VC dollars invested into fintech companies. And I think you've seen a few things as that progression has happened. One is you've seen a number of kind of disruptive entrants try to create standalone consumer brands and financial services. Some of those businesses have been incredibly well-funded. We saw Chime this week just raised at a $1.5 billion valuation. They're like a bank for kind of, you know, everyday American. Moneyline, which is another portfolio company of ours, they're really for the everyday American.
So how's this working? So do you feel that the fintech world is being decoupled? Or what's the, like,
so yes,
where
no.
are the opportunities?
So,
you know,
yeah,
like,
so,
I would say, you know, yeah, I would have wanted to invest in Chime 6 years ago.
Yeah.
But, like, what am I going to be investing in today? Where is the opportunity?
Yeah. So, I think there's a few interesting things about fintech, and then I'll get into, I have kind of four opportunities on my mind that are really interesting to me right now. But first, to preface all of that, are we seeing, like, you know, total disruption in fintech? I think the answer is no. The reason why is because heavily regulated industry. Incumbents have significant marketing budgets, significant brands, and significant amounts of assets. It's really hard to break into those things, and you need a lot of money to do it. There will be a lot of consumer fintech companies that fail as a result. There will be a few that succeed. SoFi is a good example. Moneyline is a good example. Chime is probably a pretty good example. So there will be some standalone brands that work. Now it's very hard. So that's kind of, I think when you think about fintech, there's going to be some winners, but then there's also going to be a number of companies that provide enabling technologies to traditional financial institutions. And I think that has been impacted by the fact that you've seen increasing corporate VC participation in fintech companies. So I think this year and last year, about 25% of all VC rounds in fintech had some level of corporate participation. So I think those are kind of two things that are interesting in fintech, where you'll probably never get total out and out disruption. You will with some companies. And those are opportunities that as VC investors, you want to find.
Well, it's almost like the monopoly has a little competition now. And so that they're having to innovate, right?
Yes, they are, but they can only innovate so much. And that's why I think there are certain areas of fintech that really excite me. And I think there is the chance to create standalone opportunities. So of the there's four that are kind of really on my mind. One is emerging markets fintech, particularly Latin America.
I was gonna mention global. Yeah, it feels like it's a good time to be global.
Asia is also, I mean, a massive opportunity. Look at the biggest companies in that world, Alibaba, yeah. Alipay, Tencent, etc. They're able to create really interesting fintech companies because they own the customer. Emerging markets, I think, writ large, present a really big opportunity. I actually just got back from a week in Mexico City, looking at companies. We have Credit Justo down there, our small business lender, but there's a number of other really interesting companies. And I think as you look at economies that are emerging, growing middle classes, there's a huge opportunity to create standalone consumer brands. So I think emerging markets, you can actually see new brands being created and disruption. So that's one area that I think is really interesting. And to your point about, is there going to be this bifurcation of kind of fintechs winning the day or incumbent brands winning the day? I think that's probably an area where you'll see disruption happening. The other area where you could see disruption happening is...
So it's like incumbent enhanced with fintech. You see a world where like...
In certain parts of the world, I probably see new brands totally winning the day.
Okay.
And in places like the US where it's harder, maybe less so. Although the one caveat to that, and this is the second theme that I think is really interesting, is all big brands becoming fintechs. This is a theme that I share with a colleague and an investor who I really enjoy working with, Michael Gilroy at Canaan Partners, where we sit on the board of a company called Scale Factor together. But he's really popularized this theory of big brands becoming fintechs. But I don't think it'll be far-fetched to see Amazon the bank. Because if you think about it, anybody who sits in the middle of a payments flow, or anybody who owns the customer and owns the customer trust, they can do a lot with that. So I could see an Amazon the bank happen.
Apple has more cash in their bank account than a bank does.
Well, so this is where collaboration also gets really interesting. So I believe Apple and Goldman Sachs, Marcus, actually are partnering on some sort of collaboration to provide a digital wallet. So if you think about that, that's kind of interesting because Marcus is the consumer bank Goldman and Apple has Apple Pay.
So these new trusted entities are really these tech companies who have built out sort of... Mm-hmm. I do feel that most banks have forgotten who their customer is, which has driven this sort of need for innovation globally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess Apple, Amazon, all these other companies have had to have... They need to know who their customer is at all times, so
they deliver
a good service.
They think about user experience, product design. The customer looks at them differently from a bank.
They think about the customer.
So that may make a customer trust them more. Now, the big question is, do they want to become a bank and regulated like a bank? So that I think will be the really interesting question.
Yeah, my conversations with bigger companies have always revolved around that.
Do you actually want to become a bank?
Like, I'm pretty good not being a bank right now. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of things are sort of front ends to banks. Yep. Payments, even just simple is even, or was originally just storing, the front end. It was the UI.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think the other way into the consumer is actually through the small business. So the third theme is banking the SMB. You had somebody on the podcast the other day, Keith Rabois, who worked at Square. Right. So Square started out as an SMB platform, but now has Square Cash and is going after the individual as well, which is really interesting. Right. When you think about different ways to get to the end consumer and what's the beachhead. But I do think the other really interesting thing is banking the SMB. Square is a $40 billion plus fintech company. That's a massive company. There's massive amount of services to provide to the SMB. We're investors in a company called Scale Factor, which is an automated accounting platform for SMBs based down in Austin. Canaan led their $10 million Series A. Bessemer led their $30 million Series B not too far after. But I think there's a huge opportunity to provide a suite of financial services, tools, and operations, whether it's technology services or financial products, to SMBs. And then, who knows, maybe you can end up getting to the end consumer, too, if you have the trust. Because selling to a small business owner is not too different from selling to a consumer. So again, I think there's different ways in and angles in to actually build disruptive standalone brands. But I think it'll take a while before that happens. And I think you'll also see some collaboration between incumbents like Apple and Goldman or others, just because it's so hard to build a standalone consumer brand.
Yeah, the collaboration between Goldman and Apple is fascinating to me. Boost VC writes the first check into sci-fi tech founders. We are all about investing towards a sci-fi world. If you want to get in touch with me, follow me on Twitter at Adam Draper or email me at podcast@boost.vc. Let's build the future. Okay, so that leads to a natural conversation like fintech versus crypto. Like as a part of the movement of fintech, I would say cryptocurrencies or crypto networks, as some people are trying to rebrand them as. You're saying that fintech, it's not a full disruption of finance because the incumbents are still going to be there. Where does sort of the crypto networks fit in?
It's a great question. So I'll preface all of this by saying that I think crypto is really intriguing in the sense that creating a decentralized internet, particularly in certain cases and certain business models, probably has its place. I think the jury is still out. There has to be commercialization, just like there was commercialization of the internet as we knew it in the 1990s. But that will take time. But I am a believer in kind of the creation of decentralized protocols as a way to kind of operate certain things in certain business models. Now, Bitcoin obviously has probably some merit as at least a store of value, and that operates outside the traditional financial system in a sense. Now, I think it is somewhat ironic that the possibly the largest company in crypto, Coinbase, one of the largest companies in crypto and Coinbase, is a centralized organization that is helping to support decentralized finance. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but that I think is going to be just like in traditional fintech, you have to deal with incumbents versus versus disruptors. And where's that balance going to be struck? I think in crypto, you're going to have to deal with a very similar tension of, you know, how does a centralized organization work within a decentralized framework? The jury will still be out. But again, if something like Coinbase is the on-ramp to get many people from fiat to crypto, then I think that's not necessarily a bad thing at all.
And I actually think, I mean, I'm seeing in your thesis, so I like the thesis that sort of like incumbents meet fintech, like it's sort of there needs to be emerging, otherwise the incumbents do get disrupted or, you know, I see a world where banks still exist, even though I'm an idealist. But I think the fact that there is an alternative that is slower for different types of transactions is good for that innovation.
If we're just talking about money, so let's just take Bitcoin.
Let's just talk about money because,
if we just take money and talking about Bitcoin in places where currency fluctuations are massive, Venezuela, Argentina, et cetera, being able to operate outside the traditional financial system is something that can be very helpful. So in certain cases, yes, it absolutely can be really interesting for people to be able to do that. Now, I think as somebody who's come from traditional financial services and really an experience at iCapital where we were enabling people to access private equity funds, but the administration of alternative assets can be really difficult and tough and overbearing. Kind of looking at crypto and tokenization through the lens of, you know, how can traditional financial services be married with crypto and talk about tokenization of assets. I think there's some really interesting use cases where you can kind of blend the two worlds together and collaboration between the traditional incumbents, the Fidelities of the world who are custodians, the big banks, as they think about tokenization of assets as a more efficient way to administer assets, as a more efficient way for people to own assets and do it at lower cost and lower overhead. I think that's something that's real. And that's something I think we may see, whether it's real estate assets or private equity assets, hedge fund assets. Some VC funds have tokenized their funds as well. So I think that's something that if we talk about kind of the marriage between traditional financial services world and crypto, that's something I think we see. And we've looked at a number of companies in that space. We've looked at a lot of crypto businesses in general. We've looked at a lot more than we've invested in, but certainly monitoring and certainly find it fascinating.
Well, it'd be really interesting if you'd invested in more than you'd looked at.
that would be really hard.
Well, what do you feel your job as a venture capitalist is? So, like, you're loving it, you're loving the job, and it's fun. But what do you think that job, that business is?
Yeah. So I think the job of the venture capital of a venture capitalist, particularly an early stage VC focused on pre-seed and seed, is to be the sixth man. And I mean that in a gender neutral way, but sixth man is a basketball term, right? Where the sixth man is the person who comes off the bench, is a critical player to the team. They're kind of the glue person, right?
It's the Shane Battier.
Yeah, the Andre Iguodala. Warriors fan.
Michael Lewis wrote this piece on Shane Battier and how his stats weren't necessarily that good, but when he was on the court, the team played like 30% better.
Yeah, well, look at Andre Iguodala in the NBA Finals. Like, he was on the court at the end of the game when they needed huge defensive stops. And he's helped the Warriors win championships, even though he's not necessarily the most talented player, doesn't score the most points, but he might get that crucial defensive stop, get that critical rebound, be the glue guy the team can always count on. I think that's really the role of an early stage venture capitalist, because, you know, you're not in the trenches with the company every day, but when they call on you to help make that huge customer intro, to help hire that key person for the team, to help introduce you to the next round of VCs, like, you need to be there, or even just to like be a shoulder to cry on. And if you have a really tough day, like, you want to be the first call. And I think that that's kind of one of my KPIs as a VC. Is a few years ago, an entrepreneur texted me and after connecting him to a customer that they closed, he texted me and said, "Dude, you're our sixth man." And that was where that whole idea spurred on. But that's really how I think of that seed stage venture capitalist, is how do you be the sixth man? And kind of to get into... Well,
you're cheering most of the time. And when you're playing, you know, you're solving basic hole gaps. Yeah, I like the sixth man
analogy. You got to come in and make a really high impact.
How have I not heard this analogy before? It makes way too much sense. Yeah. Sports, you know. Yay.
Yeah. Sports. Yeah. But I mean, that's, I think, look, it's so hard to start a company. I was very early at iCapital, was very early at Mosaic. I wasn't a founder, but seeing how hard founders have to work every day to build their business, like, as a VC, all I want to do is just help and be able to be incredibly helpful to them. Now, that doesn't mean just blindly, you know, telling them yes, because that can get everybody into trouble. But it means, you know, being as helpful as you possibly can without being overbearing, and to kind of put some nuts and bolts to it for people who are wondering, like, what does that mean as a VC? I mean, as a pre-seed and seed VC, I look at my kind of main job as, how do I get a company ready to graduate to Series A? And whether you think of yourself as the high school teacher that helps you get to college, or the middle school teacher that helps you get to high school because maybe the company is so early, it really means, what are all the things you can do as a business, helping them understand how they need to structure their business in terms of team, in terms of capital formation, so raising money, how much should they have raised so they don't dilute themselves too much when a Series A investor comes, how many convertible notes they do, probably not a lot, so that, you know, again, things don't get screwed up with cap tables, all the way to helping hire, helping them get their first customer, their first few customers. And that's what we as Broadhaven Ventures, we're a bunch of ex-operators. My partner, Greg Phillips, he co-founded Broadhaven. We have a fintech investment bank as well. He co-founded that business and was an executive at RJ O'Brien, a futures broker, and Citadel. So he's been an operator. And we have three other partners as well who are currently running businesses of ours in our portfolio who've all been fintech operators. And I think we think of it as, okay, we've seen how hard it is. How can we help a company really get from starting to the next phase and really level up, right? Like every I think of every stage as a startup, at a startup, as how do you get to the next level in the video game? So what are the things you need to do to actually get to that next level? And there's going to be a set of things you need to do. You need to jump over a few rocks here or there, and, you know, maybe, you know, hit a few things out of the sky or whatever video game analogy you want to use. But that's,
you're trying to get the Konami code.
Sure.
For video games.
I was, as you can tell, I was never a huge video game guy.
Konami code was up, down, left, right, A, B, B, A, A, B, B, A. And it was how developers of games, when they made it, they had to play test, but if they just made level 3, they didn't want to have to play through level 1 and 2.
Yep.
And so they had to make a code that they could type in, but people wouldn't sequentially always do. And it's in like all Sega games, and like if you go back and play it, it's a rip. But you're trying to be the cheat code.
Yeah.
And for that next level.
And the other piece of this too is we formed Broadhaven Ventures in 2016. So we are still somewhat of a startups ourselves. We've made 10 early stage investments, but we are trying to institutionalize some of those processes. So we've helped our startups out, but we've also done things like try to add to our team and add skill sets. So recently we actually just brought on a venture advisor who helps with our companies, both pre-investment and post-investment, who is the VP of HR at Instacart. Her name is Gisu Rafat Bayer. Fantastic. She helped build team culture, HR, ran the HR function at Instacart for a few years, built the executive comp plan. So it's all we're just trying to bring to the table all the tools that we can to help that entrepreneur get to the point where they can raise a Series A from you know, firms we've worked with, Canaan Partners, for example, or Bessemer, et cetera, where those investors are looking for a certain set of things and we want to help make sure our company can graduate to get there.
Burgers or tacos?
Tacos.
If you could have a dinner with any two people in the history of time, who would those two people be? And would lunch be different?
Well, if I could do lunch and dinner, that would be great because then I could get more. I could cover more people.
See, I'm trying a new format for the Boost VC podcast. So
it's a great question.
Well, it's a good question. See, I'll give you mine.
Give me yours.
Well, the new format is not doing calling it a lightning round. Okay. And I'm trying to ease them in, but I'm starting with the what's your definition of success nearer to the beginning, because I think it's sort of interesting to hear it and then hear the stories of everyone.
Yep.
I don't know if I need to explain this on the actual podcast, but now everyone who's listening knows why I did this. But I still enjoy the funny questions. But my answer to the dinner is Stan Lee and J.K. Rowling.
Okay.
So it would be Stanley, J.K. Rowling, because world builders. I've always looked up to world builders. But if I had to have another dinner, it would be the South Park guys and the people who created Rick and Morty. And I think I could – actually, that is actually possible today because
they're
both living.
You can do burgers at one and tacos at the other, right?
Yes, burgers and tacos at
one. Well, that's great. Then you don't have to choose one or the other. So
actually, at my wedding, we served burgers and tacos. So it was family style and we had burgers and tacos. Okay. So well, who's yours?
Mine too. So one is my dad. So he passed away when I was 15. I would love to be able to actually talk to him about business. He was an entrepreneur himself. So that would be one because I was just a kid when he passed away, and it'd be fun to be able to talk about the business. And kind of on that theme, I think it'd be also really interesting, just somebody who's actually built a totally non-tech business, but Warren Buffett, just from the perspective of like, how do you think about building businesses and brands over time, which is so different. And to hear his perspective on tech companies as somebody who spends all my days in technology, I think would be really interesting juxtaposition.
I've tweeted about this. I think Warren Buffett is, you know, next level. But it's so funny. The reason that he bashes crypto networks and Bitcoin and all that stuff is like, you know, 10 of his biggest investments are like he owns 8 banks or something like it's his biggest investments are JP Morgan, Amex. If you look at the 10 of the top 15, it's like all banks. So I think it's fascinating that, like, you know, he knows where his money is.
Yeah. And he's done this for 60, 70 years. Literally. I also just love people who are so passionate about what they're doing. I mean, not everybody gets excited about reading annual reports.
Or writing them.
But he does, right? Yeah. And like, I think we look at entrepreneurs and talk to entrepreneurs every day. So it's interesting to just think about like what makes people successful and like, why some people end up building amazing businesses or not, and not just working hard, but loving what you do so much, where you're just immersed in it, where you've kind of integrated your work and your life together, is just so fascinating to me.
A friend of mine, his name's Alex Banyan, he wrote a book called The Third Door, and it was based off of what makes people successful.
Yep.
And the book ended up being like the stories of his quests to meet the people. So it was like, he wrote down 20 names and he went and made sure to meet them all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it starts with figuring out how to get to Bill Gates. And then he goes through like every single, like how he raised the money to be able to do it. He was supposed to be pre-med. It's great. What makes successful people successful is like a fascinating concept. So your dad and Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
I think it'd be pretty great.
I think so. The question is burgers or tacos though.
Yeah, I know. Still. Well, thank you for being on the Boost VC podcast.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Awesome, Michael. Unfortunately, we don't have time for Mark Zuckerberg today. So subscribe to the podcast and tune in next week. Thank you so much for listening in during your busy day to learn about all these awesome sci-fi people. For more information on what we do, check out our website at www.boost.vc. Also, we love to hear from our listeners, so rate us, drop us a comment on any streaming service you use. We would love to hear any feedback. Until next week, I'm Adam Draper, rocketing to the future. Pew, pew, pew!